This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Christine Castle, has written a new book about Medicare from her perspective as a doctor who has spent her career caring for Medicare patients. She's also dealt with Medicare as the daughter of elderly parents who have since passed away. Castle is a specialist in geriatric medicine and the president of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Her new book is called Medicare Matters: What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare. I asked her first about reactions from older patients to the new Medicare prescription drug plan.
Everyone is confused. Everyone wishes there weren't so many choices. It's interesting, you know, many of the advertisements that you hear about healthcare in general are about choice. And people have come to think that choice equals quality in healthcare. But in fact, there is such a thing as too many choices, particularly when they aren't that really relevant to what it is that you need.
What about from your perspective as a physician? How is the new plan functioning?
It worries me because I'm afraid that people who need it the most are going to have the most trouble getting it. That is to say, people of low income, people who are confused or don't have good cognitive function, people who have major mental health needs, for example. And those are the people for whom this model of choice doesn't really make any sense. So they'll get arbitrarily assigned to some plan. And as I'm sure you've heard, many of them are falling between the cracks, the computer glitches haven't quite worked, etc. The other thing that is likely to really be a problem for people with any serious chronic illness, and particularly the Medicare patients who I am familiar with who have multiple chronic illnesses, is the complexity of this donut hole arrangement. The fact that a certain amount is covered up to a certain amount, then you get to that $2,200 amount, and then you get no coverage, and then when you get to $5,000, you get more coverage. It's very confusing. It's going to operate like that year after year, the way it's currently designed. So there isn't a sort of a logical, stable approach that people can expect.
Do doctors have to do any more administrative work with this prescription plan?
Absolutely. The first thing doctors have to do is answer patients' questions. Now, we have a problem with that in our healthcare system anyway, because there are so few physicians, generally primary care physicians, who are willing and able to actually answer patients' questions and their families' questions. Most doctors are specialists, that you see them just for this problem or that problem, and they aren't equipped to answer your questions about the drug benefit. You know, another thing that is really a problem about this, I'm sure you have seen the stories in the press about people, baby boomers like ourselves, helping their parents get online, figure out which you know of the plans is best for them. And the way you do that is you put in all the medications you're currently on, and then it runs an analysis and tells you what's the best deal. Well, that assumes that those are going to be the drugs you're on for the rest of your life. And nothing could be a more unrealistic assumption in this day of rapidly evolving medical science. Plus, as we age, we know that things happen and your medical problems are likely to get more complex, not less so.
On the whole, I think you feel very grateful for Medicare, both as,
yes.
You know, as somebody who was helping to take care of elderly parents, and as a physician who specializes in geriatric medicine. But you see some problems with Medicare the way it exists now, and that's what your new book, Medicare Matters, addresses. So I'd like to talk about some of those issues that you address in the book. You say that the Medicare system is no longer compatible with how geriatric medicine is practiced. And one example that you give is the kind of medical teamwork that's especially needed in geriatric medicine. Would you explain why that teamwork is so important and how you think Medicare neglects to really deal with that?
An elderly patient, somebody who's 85 or 86 years old, who has 6 or 7 different chronic conditions, heart failure, hypertension, diabetes, arthritis, maybe mild dementia, osteoporosis that needs to be treated, that's not unusual. Any single doctor alone in an office or in an office with a nurse is never going to be able to adequately manage all of that patient's problems because they need interaction with themselves and, when necessary, with family members or other support systems in the community to manage unexpected events that happen. You don't want to be calling 911 every time you have a dizzy spell. And yet, most doctors' offices aren't really prepared to respond to a telephone call for something like that. How do I manage that? Patient education. You have 14, 15 different medications. They interact with each other. You're going to multiple different specialists. None of them know what the others are prescribing. And somebody, one person, has to manage the interaction of all those, make some decisions about what's better, what's not, hopefully reduce some of those medications or the complexity that they have. Finally, you treat the patient, not the disease. Now, that sounds like a cliche. We hear that all the time. But there are times when treating a specific disease can lose sight of what that person's function and functional goals are because there's, for example, side effects of a medication. Or the patient may decide not to pursue aggressive surgery, let's say for a knee replacement, if they have a lot of other problems and their quality of life balance is just a decision not to do that. That's where you really need geriatric medicine and is in coordinating that team. Plus, all the other specialists that are involved in the care of that patient.
So in what ways is that difficult to do under the current Medicare system?
Because Medicare doesn't pay for any of those activities that I just described to you. Medicare pays me as a physician when the patient comes to my office and for a visit, I see the patient. Medicare pays for laboratory tests, for x-rays. Medicare pays when the patient goes into the hospital. But if I have a patient, let's say with heart failure, who's getting worse, and I find that out, call the patient up, discover that there are some medication changes I could make to avoid the patient having to come into my office and potentially go in the hospital, I get paid nothing for that. So it's actually in my financial interest to order unnecessary tests or even tests that have been done by somebody else, rather than go to the time and effort of trying to track down the results of those tests from another specialist, there's no reason. It makes my office actually more efficient for me just to repeat these tests.
My guest is Dr. Christine Castle. Her new book is called Medicare Matters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Christine Castle, and she's the author of the book Medicare Matters. She is a physician specializing in geriatric medicine. She's also the president of the American Board of Internal Medicine. There are certain rules for rehab and nursing homes that I know you find frustrating as well, rules in terms of what and when Medicare will cover, will provide financial coverage for that. Give us an example of a frustration that you have with the coverage for rehabilitation.
The most frustrating thing for rehabilitation is that it only covers rehab services up to a patient's plateauing, and they have to keep getting better in order for Medicare to keep paying for it. Well, the patients that I see, people who might be very frail, need to have maintenance physical therapy in order to keep their muscle strength as they get frailer. And if they stop that therapy, they get worse. But that's not enough of a justification for payment to continue. You've got to be recovering. It's that same acute care model. If you've had a hip replacement or a broken hip or cardiac rehab after a heart attack or a cardiac surgery, then you need to have that rehab model. That's more of an acute care model. But in terms of maintenance, that isn't built into the system.
And what about when somebody's eligible to be in a nursing home or a rehab unit?
Well, this, I'm sure your listeners know, is not a straightforward business at all and is very variable all over the country. But it is fair enough to say that Medicare has never been committed to covering most long-term care expenses. And so it constrains what it covers just to things that are just post-hospital. And there's various ways of defining that, but whatever that few month period is that you might need to get over an acute care hospitalization. Now, there could be a lot of efficiencies to our whole healthcare system if we had one system covering both acute and long-term care. But since we don't, it's very easy for the acute care system, the hospital, to say, okay, let's send this patient, it's time for the patient to go to the nursing home, and then somebody else has to pay for it, either the family or often the Medicaid program.
Another example of how Medicare pays or doesn't pay has to do with hospice. And there are certain rules. If you want Medicare reimbursement for a hospice, you have to agree to give up certain things. What are those things?
You have to agree not to use any kind of, quote, curative treatments. And that's a very complex thing, how that's defined. Not to call an ambulance if you feel sick, that you call the hospice team and they come to your home. And the reason for this is because the idea was that most of the people using hospice are people who are at the end of life, and they probably wouldn't need an ICU, for example. But they might very well need an emergency room visit if their hospice team isn't set up directly to care for everything that they need. A good hospice team could be, but sometimes, for example, someone who's suffering from advanced cancer may have a pneumonia, may have some kind of infection that you're not going to cure. It's not going to lengthen their life, but if you treat it, it will reduce their suffering, help their breathing, reduce pain, for example. It might need a hospitalization. And intravenous drugs, for example, or other kinds of things that are considered more high tech. So that just tells you why it's so difficult for a government program to set arbitrary limits on what's covered and what's not. And why, if you have an interdisciplinary team with geriatric experts and palliative care experts, they could personalize that management for each patient.
So we have a dilemma here. You're saying that Medicare, which is extraordinarily expensive, doesn't really cover enough, and some of what it covers seems kind of arbitrary. So to solve the problems that you're saying would mean changing the system so that it's even more expensive, you know, at a time when the government is already in debt, there's a huge deficit, and everybody's trying to cut money wherever they can. So it seems very unlikely that Congress is about to change Medicare to expand what is reimbursable. So, you know, trying to look at it like realistically, what do you think some of the options are?
You're exactly right. We can't just keep saying more and more and more. And we particularly can't be saying more and more and more at today's prices. So what I'm calling for in the book is that all of us as a group of citizens of the United States begin to look at this program as something that is part of our social contract with the government. And that as we do that, we understand that it benefits not just the elderly, but it benefits families. As you and I know, if Medicare wasn't there for our parents and for our friends' parents, we would be paying for that medical care for those people. And already the burden often does fall of the organizing and the managing onto the families. So I see Medicare as a family benefit, not just a benefit for the elderly. Now, that said, it is also a huge market force because all of this fancy new technology, new drugs, et cetera, primarily is used in older people because that's when all of us start to face major illnesses and illnesses that can benefit from this. And we have a marketplace system of healthcare in this country. So we have lots of industries who are doing very well in the business of selling medical care. These include insurance companies, pharmaceutical industry, device manufacturers, many physician specialists, and medical groups. So we have a very brisk and effective marketplace in many aspects of medical care, but we pay more by far than any other country in the world for medical specialties, for drugs, for devices, and even for hospitalizations. So it seems to me that if we as a nation really believe that an effective Medicare system is essential for successful aging, for keeping our society productive as we're all getting older, that we have to figure out a way to rein in those costs.
You recommend a form of rationing in your book. And rationing always sounds really horrible, like you'll only be allotted so much, and then if you get sicker than that, you're out of luck. You've gotten your share already. So what is the kind of rationing that you think would work?
I think that we are already rationing healthcare. If you look at the donut hole in the Medicare drug benefit, that's a form of rationing. It's saying we're only going to pay for so much. Rationing doesn't say that you can't have the things that aren't covered. It just says you have to pay for them. So what I would prefer is to see a basic package of healthcare services or something like a monthly fee that could be a capitation fee that clinical groups could manage. And then if people wanted to buy something above and beyond that, they would be free to do so. So it doesn't have that dreaded idea of rationing that, quote, I can't get this. I think Medicare ought to have the right to negotiate prices with drug companies. As you know, in the legislation, that is explicitly forbidden. Every other nation in the world negotiates prices, lower prices than what we pay in this country for those medications. So it's those kinds of things that I think if we agreed collectively that this is an important program, we could do.
You're very critical of the new Medicare prescription plan.
Yes.
You're critical of Medicare the way it is now because there are a lot of things that aren't covered that you think should be covered or should be covered differently than they are currently covered. At the same time, there's a lot you like about Medicare. What are some of the things that you actually like about the program?
I think it's very important that we keep the Medicare program as a government program in this country. And I worry that because people are focusing on its flaws, that they may think the answer is just to throw it all over to the private sector and private plans, which I think are not going to turn out to be as efficient. The things I like about it are, first of all, that it's universal. It covers everyone and covers everyone with similar and comparable benefits. So it makes it easy for patients to understand it and easy to administer. Leads to the second thing I like about it. It has very low administrative costs. Medicare costs, administrative costs are 3 to 5% compared to almost all of the private sector, which is between 15 and 25%. That's a lot of wasted money that goes to administrators rather than going to deliver health care. And the last thing that I think is really important about it is that it supports innovation and training in medical care. It actually supports young physicians getting good training.
With this new prescription drug benefit in effect for Medicare, where do you see Medicare heading in the future?
I worry about that, Terry. I worry because I think that a lot of people think that Medicare needs to be more like the private sector of healthcare and commercial insurance. And that's the model for the Medicare drug benefit. It's clearly the way that was established. And what that's done is to make it very inefficient, lead to all the confusion that we talked about earlier, and I don't think promises to solve the fundamental problems of Medicare. So what that says to me is that the market system has failed. And if we go too far down that road, we may not be able to put it back together again as a social insurance program. The most important thing about the universal coverage of Medicare is that you spread the risk across the whole population. And as soon as you start slicing and dicing that, you have insurance companies that take the healthier people, leaving the sicker ones behind, and pretty soon you can't afford any kind of insurance program for the very sick people. So it's essential that we somehow keep this as a universal program.
My guest is Dr. Christine Castle. Her new book is called Medicare Matters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. Christine Castle, is a specialist in geriatric medicine. Her new book is called Medicare Matters. We've had to navigate through geriatric medicine, not just as a doctor who specializes in that field, but as a daughter who had elderly parents who have since passed away.
That's right.
What were some of the conditions and illnesses that your parents had to deal with in their later lives?
Well, my mother had serious arthritis and also dementia, and was determined to stay in her own home. And so we had to manage her ability to move around and the medications that she was on and multiple physicians that she saw. She developed breast cancer and needed to have a lumpectomy to have that removed, and then radiation treatment. And managing all of those through multiple different hospitals, we were very fortunate because there was where she lived, there were a network of volunteers who would pitch in, drive her to the radiation treatment, help manage her care at home. And between my sister and myself, we spent a huge amount of time. My sister lived nearby, so she had the major burden of this. And I would fly in and out on weekends. So it was a big effort together to kind of manage that kind of care. But she did stay at home, and I think that was, you know, something that was very much better than having her had to go to a nursing home. In my father's case, he lived longer and was quite active and vigorous, and then developed a malignancy and was treated by chemotherapy for the malignancy. There was a situation where it was clear that he had to go into the hospital in order to get all of the drugs, including something as simple as an injection to help keep his blood counts up, when a visiting nurse could have just as easily come to his home and given it to him, but it wouldn't get reimbursed that way. It would only get reimbursed if he came into the hospital. So that was a good example of something that was very inconvenient for him, very inconvenient for us.
Because you had to help him get there.
Because we had to help him get there, right. And didn't really, to me as a physician, make a lot of sense.
What was the end of life for your father like?
He died in the hospital where he had been admitted because of complications from his chemotherapy. He was actively receiving chemotherapy at the time. And as it became clear over the course of the hospitalization that he was not going to get better, he made it very clear to all of us that he did not want aggressive treatment, that he was a believer in hospice, and thought that this time had come, and he didn't want to be intubated. He didn't want to be on a respirator. So that was all very clear, and I think the nurses who took care of him were excellent. But the hospital didn't have a palliative care program. I asked at the time, I said, do you have a palliative care team who can come now and help manage his symptoms? Because he was very short of breath. This was a situation where the problem wasn't so much pain, but it was just that he struggled to breathe, and that's a very difficult symptom to manage. And they didn't. This was an otherwise very good hospital, but they didn't have anybody in palliative care. None of the interns and residents involved in his care who were otherwise very good knew what to do. So the only thing they could think of to do was to put him in the intensive care unit, because those were people who knew how to manage people who couldn't breathe. So in retrospect, I now have worked with a number of hospitals that have implemented palliative care teams in the hospital for this kind of situation. Because much as all of us might think that what we'd like is to be at home when we die, not in the hospital, it just doesn't always work out that way. And people do die in hospitals, and there's absolutely no reason why you can't deliver the same quality of palliative care that hospice gives you at home in the hospital.
It must have been so frustrating for you as a daughter and as a doctor specializing in geriatric medicine to know what could be done what could have been done to improve your father's situation, and yet to be helpless to do anything about it.
It was frustrating, and it really inspired me to continue to devote a lot of my efforts to helping to improve this situation.
Dr. Castle, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Christine Castle is the author of Medicare Matters. She's the president of the American Board of Internal Medicine.